You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 8th of December 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, the entirely predictable response to the United States' recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital. My guests Carlotta Rabello, Henry Rhys Sheridan and Tom Edwards will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the refloating of the United States of Europe, the furtherance of same-sex marriage to two more countries, and why you, yes you personally, are almost certainly wrong about pretty much everything. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Monocle's Carlotta Rabello, Henry Rhys Sheridan and Tom Edwards. Welcome all. And we will start in the Middle East, where at least one person has been killed and hundreds injured in protests against the United States' recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital and associated promise to move its embassy there too. This was denounced, of course, as a bad idea by everyone who could see this kind of response coming, which is to say everyone. Tom, first of all, the thing that perplexes me most about this is what is, if you look at this from the United States upside, or from the United States point of view rather, what is the upside?
It's very difficult to identify at all, Andrew. I think one of the most extraordinary things about this is precisely how avoidable this uptick in violence has been. And we've seen, perhaps predictably, as you suggested in your introduction, urgings of, you know, the next intifada. We know that once that rhetoric starts being bandied around, things tend to get ugly. What I can't understand is why this benefits anybody other than Donald Trump's own belief that he's somehow honouring a campaign pledge. Now, we know that he was very committed to trying to make this move and that it's been made clear to him that it's not only not politically expedient, but ultimately probably impossible. And what I find particularly extraordinary, specifically about the case of Jerusalem, is it's an issue over which both sides have, reluctantly and bloodily over a number of years, but arrived at a sort of broad consensus, which is, well, that's one thing that we're never going to see eye to eye on, and it's kind of largely been left alone from both fronts. And it's a measure of the sort of terribly dangerous blend of ignorance and vanity and narcissism that Trump has, that he's thrown this issue needlessly right back into centre stage. I mean, one of the things I find particularly depressing is people said, well, that's done for the peace process. Well, it was already not even floundering. There wasn't really one, but this just serves
Are you suggesting, Tom, that you didn't think Jared Kushner had everything absolutely under control?
Well, no, but it just, you know, we can all deal with the prospect of this sort of futile process not going anywhere, but this is Trump, you know, running that even futile prospect over and then backing up just to make sure.
I think for Trump, it was quite simply just someone told him, waltzed into the Oval Office and told him, no country ever has done this since the foundation of the state in 1948, and he wanted to become the first country to do so, regardless of how insensitive, ignorant that decision was, and without any
God, that sounds depressingly plausible, doesn't
yes,
it?
Yes, exactly, and that's my take, at least.
I also just want to bring to your attention the fact that there are potentially material political gains for electoral gains for Trump among the US electorate. There are lots of groups that vociferously support Israel and Jerusalem as being the capital of Israel for lots of different reasons. Mm-hmm. One very weird group is, of course, evangelical Christians who believe, for some reason, that Jerusalem being the capital of an Israeli state will bring Christ back sooner, I think. I may have mangled their belief system.
It's shorthand, but it's ballpark.
It's ballpark. Now, it's easy, I think, when you're talking about this announcement purely in terms of geopolitics to forget the fascinating, frankly, ideological soup which kind of bubbles beneath it and which can make real things happen.
Are they banking panel on, this is my own pet theory, this is, as has been pointed out, a campaign pledge by Donald Trump. My own pet theory as to why it's taken him until now to do it is that he's doing it at the onset of winter rather than the middle of summer. and therefore they're banking on the idea that people might lose interest in standing out in the streets chucking rocks at soldiers and go home faster than they otherwise might if it was 32 degrees.
Would he think that far ahead?
No, but the people around him who do the, you know, thinking such as it is for him might have.
I don't know if it's a question of it simply just waiting for support to be confirmed. You know, 250 rabbis so far have signed a letter thanking him for the decision. You know, Netanyahu has been just praises about this decision that Donald Trump has made. So I don't know if it's just about, you know, having those in place so that this doesn't become as controversial as it actually is, and to show that he actually has done something, even if it's something that shouldn't have been done in the first place. But it's actually the first sign of some action, that and the Muslim ban, and you can't point anything else.
Well, we'll follow this story next week. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out over the weekend. The Friday afternoon after prayers, the first Friday after this happened, was always likely to be lively, but it will be interesting to see if there is much momentum to it. But let's look now at the UK, where police and firefighters in Wolverhampton have laboured to rescue a citizen who cemented his own head into a microwave oven, possibly out of concern that we did not yet have sufficient metaphor for Brexit. On which note, some sort of progress does appear to have been made vis-a-vis the Irish border and slash but. Martin Schulz, leader of Germany's Social Democrats, has declared his enthusiasm for a United States of Europe by 2025. Much though I would like to concentrate with deep specificity, if that is even a word, on the bloke in Wolverhampton who concreted his head into a microwave oven, I think you could probably stare at that for quite some time without really perceiving much in the way of rhyme or reason. You could possibly say the same thing about Brexit. Henry, is it possible that this week, at the end of it, Theresa May has actually done quite well?
I think that she has done well, if you judge it according to the standards of ensuring her immediate political survival within UK politics. I do not think that what is happening is a good thing. No matter how
Brexit. Do you think it might be a less bad thing than it looked like it might have been this time a week ago?
It's not the worst of all possible worlds at this stage, but that is largely due to the fact that she seems to have kept the door open for ensuring that Britain will be able to maintain aspects of the relationship that it already has with the EU in place, which begs the question: why are we doing this?
Well, that's been a question ever since the vote even took place. So, but I do think it doesn't look as bad simply because it just is a win for the European Union. And as someone that might remain the only European on the table in a couple of years, it was amazing to read the document and to see how the concessions were mostly made by the UK. The only concession that the EU made was that it's not going to ask the UK to pay for the mover's bill of the EU agencies out of London.
I have to say, I thought that was an unnecessarily gloating touch by the EU there.
Hey, you need to take advantage when they come at you. But yes, I don't think it's... First, there's a sign of a deal, which we've been hearing for the past couple of weeks, the conversation of, no deal is better than a bad deal. So finally, there's some sign that actually there's going to be some sort of deal. And as Henry was pointing out, with a lot of the things that already are in place in the United Kingdom. So I just think it's a really good day for Europe, and for Theresa May is some damage control for now.
I have a cynic's view about that.
Surprise me.
About the agencies and the EU's generous waiving of Britain's responsibility to pay for that. By certain accounts, almost all of those people who work for those agencies in London are not eager, anecdotally, to leave to Amsterdam, Paris, wherever, will therefore be granted leave to stay in London and will be required almost en bloc to work at the new agency we have to set up and pay for to do essentially all the same work that agency did before. So the reason the EU is not insisting on us paying that bill is it will probably be very modest, because all those people will still be here, re-employed at great cost to Britain, and ergo the British taxpayers, many of whom insisted on voting to leave.
We should look at this suggestion by Martin Schulz, leader of Germany's Social Democrats, of course, who got resoundingly trounced at the last election, but may yet still nevertheless end up back in government. This thing, this dream of a United States of Europe, it when it's talked about in this country, in Britain, it's usually been invoked as a reason to be, you know, it was a standard stock stump piece of rhetoric for the Leave campaign. The idea was that, you know, this is where the Eurocrats ultimately want to take it. Does anyone think it's an actually desirable idea?
I think it depends what you sort of decide that Martin Schulz is attempting to do here. Now, domestically, his position is rather weak because, well, it's interesting. It's weak and strong, by which I mean, obviously, he pledged to be in opposition to Merkel, and it looks like he's been rather strong-armed into reining back on that, so he may yet be kingmaker, even though he knows it's quite damaging for his own party's political future to be in it, the aforementioned Grand Coalition. But I think what he's doing here is it's a bit of a distraction tactic. And when he talks about the United States of Europe, you're quite right, Andrew, that was shorthand from your Farageists and so on. But I think he's talking about a restatement to a broader European unity, a restatement of the commonality. And I think the time is right, particularly if we go with Carlotta's reading that this was rather a win for Brussels today, and indeed the other 27. It seems to me reasonably well judged to be delivering this kind of rhetoric now.
No, there are two things that I flag up with this. The first is how during the campaign, Schulz was, for someone that had served in a high position within the European institutions, oddly quiet about Europe during the campaign. We know exactly the reasons, because of the rise of the Alternative for Deutschland and all of that, and trying not to lose some of the more conservative electorate. So saying this now at the party conference is, I just think, trying to appease his base and that prospect of the Grand Coalition to come back. The second one is, I think we're giving Schulz too much credit. And There's been a few comparisons already made with a speech that Emmanuel Macron gave in Sorbonne in September, when at the time was described as the most pro-Europe speeches by an European leader of the past couple of decades, exactly suggesting, and in the case of Macron, it's funny because he suggested 2024, not for saying he wants the United States of Europe to be formed and up and ready to go, but he suggested that by then he wanted a bigger sense of federalism in the European continent, particularly with the Eurozone, so the countries that have the euro as their currency, which has for a long time, including in this country, being pointed out as one of the big problems of the European Union. There's no proper regulation of the currency in these different countries. And Macron suggested the creation of an Europe finance minister of its own the European budget and so on. And he suggested that by 2024. So I just think Martin Schulz is just trying to balance the old France-Germany axis here and not exactly as innovative as he might have hoped to be.
Henry, is it ultimately, though, a reasonable idea or an even plausible ambition? Is it possible to completely sublimate all of Europe's nationalisms into one, you know, federal state?
No, I don't think it's possible or desirable. I don't think that total political union is possible within Europe. And as a result of that, I don't think that economic union is possible. One interesting caveat that Schulz made as part of this call for a United States of Europe is that basically anyone who doesn't sign up within a few years, I think by 2025, will have to stay out. Now, is he being serious about that? I think that you could see the EU taking a slightly more combative stance against member states who don't toe the line. Just yesterday, we found out that the European Commission was going to sue three of its states, Poland, Hungary and the Czech Republic, over their refusal to take in asylum seekers. So I think that that kind of more strident pose on the part of the EU could become a flavour of operation for the organisation. I do not think that total unity is possible.
I think one of the most positive points about Brexit, if not the only, is that for the first time has forced the EU to look at itself, which they have claimed to have done for the past couple of years. But actually, you know what, if something doesn't change, this Brexit is just going to keep on happening with the other 27. And this idea of the United States of Europe, there's a lot of faults and flaws with it, and I'm not sure if it's the best solution and the way forward, but at least moves the conversation in a different direction in this idea that of European identity, which in a lot of countries, including on its own, has been an issue. No one feels European, and whereas in the continent, you do feel European.
I was going to say, I slightly disagree with Carter there. I don't think that the other 27 will be constantly looking to see who's next to go. I just think the EU can kick back, relax, watch this horror show unfold, safe in the knowledge that that's going to keep everyone well clear of asking for it for at least the next two decades.
Well, let's take a look now at Australia, your presenter's homeland, where scenes nonetheless joyous for being woefully overdue erupted in the country's parliament as Australia's lawmakers finally legalised same-sex marriage, having dragged their feet via a pointless and rancorous plebiscite campaign. Elsewhere this week, the Supreme Court of Austria, that's not to be confused with Australia, they're the one with the better cakes and few venomous octopuses, ruled that same-sex couples will be able to marry from 2019. That's the year, not later tonight. If I've done the maths right, that will be 25 countries which have now got with the programme since 2001, when the Netherlands went first. Henry, on the one hand, this is a really encouraging story in which a great deal of progress has been made very, very quickly. And, you know, that's 25 countries which for centuries and millennia had not countenanced same-sex marriage have changed their minds and done the decent thing in just 16 years. But in the short term, at least, do you think we're approaching the plausible limits of how far this might spread?
So I remember sitting in a conversation between you and Peter Tatchell, is it?
Yes.
The very prominent and effective gay rights campaigner and marriage equality campaigner, who was, as you would expect, incredibly insightful on this topic. I think one of the main takeaways for me from hearing that conversation was that any more progress on this issue, and indeed any progress that has been made on this issue so far, has to respect the cultures of the countries and the regions in which the progress has been made, or we hope it's going to be made. The awkward fact of the matter is that vast chunks of the globe have a culture which may not be the most fertile ground for immediate progress on this issue the near future. And I think that trying to ram Western-style gay rights down countries that perhaps aren't as amenable to its throat is not the way to go.
It struck me for a long time, I've been, you know, aside from being personally embarrassed that Australia had failed to get with the programme on this, it struck me for a long time that Australia was possibly the strangest holdout, given that, you know, it's a country where the annual gay Mardi Gras has been televised nationally by the state broadcaster since the early 90s. It is, you know, I'm glad that this has now happened, but which now does strike you all as the weirdest country that still hasn't done it?
Well, I think one thing that's interesting is exactly that point, which is these bastions of, I guess you talk about progressive and inclusive society, where they have not been up to speed on this. And Australia was, for my money, pretty much out on its own for precisely the reasons
it did strike me as just weird for years.
What I think is interesting and where I think Henry makes an interesting point is, what about countries where, yes, granted, there may be an extraordinarily small-C conservative social approach to change in very well long-established traditions of equality and so on, but where, nevertheless, we're talking about a very advanced and progressive culture. It was very interesting remarks pointed out to me by a colleague from a member of one of the legislative assemblies in Japan, talking about how difficult it is there. I think she's the only openly gay legislator in the country. Now, this isn't an extraordinarily traditional country, but also very progressive in many ways. And I hope that when we see what's happened in Australia and these other cases, you mentioned the flurry since really the turn of the millennium, Andrew, it will prompt people to ask questions that are specifically uncomfortable and do involve a bit of a backlash. I think there are still outposts where this is a conversation that should be driven along, perhaps with a bit of external influence.
Tom, in the mould of Japan, perhaps, could I venture Singapore? Or is that totally crazy? It's a liberal society, forward-looking, technological.
But it is amazing how, not just how fast, how many countries have done this. I know it's still only 25, but the changes that within some of those countries, the idea that, you know, that 20, 30 years ago, that Ireland would not merely legalise same-sex marriage but have a gay Taoiseach would have seemed completely incredible. And yet here we are.
Exactly. And I mean, it's, you know, by definition, difficult, nigh on impossible, to predict the kind of demographic shift and cultural shift that will lead to outcomes like that.
Well, and Andrew, Ireland is a particularly good example, because if you're talking about quite literally hundreds of years of incredibly entrenched belief, absolutely, you know, immovably set in its ways, and the progress there has been astonishing. Now, Ireland has a few other, I don't know, things that outwardly look rather ironic at the lightest and frankly hypocritical at best, but it's made amazing
strides.
You get
to elaborate on that.
And if Ireland can do it, then I agree with Henry. Why not Singapore? Why not Japan? Why not the other outliers that remain?
Okay, well, it's time now for us to attend to the always enjoyable work of mocking the credulity of one's fellow citizens via Ipsos Mori's annual Perils of Perception poll, which reliably demonstrates how completely wrong absolutely everyone is about almost everything. As a general rule, it turns out almost nothing in this world is actually as bad as generally imagined. I do really enjoy this poll every year. It's always, well, on the one hand, it's terrifying, but on the other hand, it is always a considerable delight. Did any particular results leap out at anybody?
I mean, the most politically fraught ones obviously are to do with, I think for me the headline one was estimations of foreign-born prisoners.
Yep.
Right? That's the kind of juicy one. And it revealed everyone to be massively racist and xenophobic, which you perhaps could have predicted.
But people do they massively overestimate immigration, they massively overestimate teenage pregnancy.
That's from terrorism as well.
Massively overestimate terrorism, you know.
I mean,
crime.
Some of the guesses on teenage pregnancy, I think some of the average guesses in some of the country was something like 20 to 30%
the
of
average
all teenage females.
The average guess was 20%, and the average correct answer was 2%. That, my friends,
I mean, that's a deficit.
Is a misperception.
But the interesting question here to me is, why do people do this? Is it just because so much, in fact, possibly more than ever, people's experience or understanding of the world is mediated by the media, which by definition only reports things which are unusual or extraordinary?
Well, quite. The idea is negative sells, positive doesn't. There was a very good piece.
But also just unusual sells.
Well, absolutely. But also negative and also frightening. People's perceptions are informed by their own fears. And we've seen things like Brexit that have been driven by paranoia and fury about a problem that perhaps doesn't confront most people day to day.
I don't know. I don't overestimate the number of heights there are in the world.
No, but I see. I wonder whether you avoid more things than you need to for precisely that reason.
Also, heights aren't necessarily a thing that society or politicians can do something about. Well, they can.
I, for one, would like to see them
Let's hope Donald Trump isn't listening, because he'll start saying, we're going to take down those mountains. We're going to do all of this.
Certain mountain heights. But the point, I think, that, you know, if we're looking at it from the media and news perspective, the point is, I think that it's those issues that can be... I mean, you know, I'm sure you have experience of this, Tom, from working in newspapers. One of the big things that sells a story is, can blame be assigned? And, you know, with stuff like heights, obviously, blame can't be assigned as easily as, for example, teenage pregnancy, an incredibly complex social problem that no one fully understands, but everyone can find a scapegoat for.
And
genius.
And you can apportion blame for negative developments. It's much more difficult to apportion credit for positive developments. Max Rosa, I'll quote here from Oxford University, who I read in a story around this poll news today, said, you could legitimately have run the headline in the newspaper, number of people in extreme poverty fell by 137,000 since yesterday,
yep,
every day for the past 25 years. But A, that would be predictable, and B, it's a good news story, which isn't news, which isn't newsworthy. It's all driven by, sadly, the fact that negativity trumps
Compels.
One of my favourite numbers was how 60% of Brits thought they were one of the top three like more drunk nations when actually they're on number six, so it's not too bad, but thinking they were indeed on the top three with Russia and US, but no.
So come on, our fellow Britons, get drinking.
Get to the pub.
Oh no, that's not the...
But well, finally tonight though, we do have a good news story. It is excellent news, in fact, for anybody seeking reason to feel less guilty about the pizza they're about to send out for. Because far from being a couch-bound troglodyte too bone idle to cook for yourself, you will in fact be consuming a UNESCO-protected expression of culture after a fashion. UNESCO's Intangible Heritage List, an entrancingly eccentric catalogue of weird things folks do, has been joined by Neapolitan pizza twirling. It is now reckoned the match of Belgian horseback shrimp fishing, Costa Rican ox herding, and the Luxembourgeois hopping procession of Echternach. I am not making any of those things up. I did not know when I woke up this morning that Belgians fish for shrimp from horseback. That is an actual... Who was the first guy who decided...
That should be an Olympic sport.
Who was the first guy who decided, I'm going to give this a crack. Saddle up. I'm walking out to sea on my horse to catch shrimp.
Maybe he went, shrimp to, the, specifically. He went to the fishing site on his horse and thought, yeah, I'm not going to get off. I'll just stay up here. Pretty comfortable saddle.
Yeah, it's the horse that gets wet, not me.
There you go.
Actually, yeah, put like that. It's pretty good thinking. But what do we think of Neapolitan pizza twirling? Is it justified in being included on UNESCO's Intangible Heritage List?
100%.
Yes.
Yeah, who's going to dissent from that? Definitely.
I was hoping somebody would. This could be a dry debate otherwise.
Especially when one of the people driving the campaign said if it got onto the list, they would deliver free pizzas for an entire week in Naples. So... You can't disagree with
get
that.
There. If you've had the good fortune to visit Naples and head to what claims to be, I think reliably respected as the home of the Neapolitan pizza, sample the fare. It's quite extraordinary, Andrew. There's an all-white, I can't remember exactly what it is. There's obviously no tomatoes
I have been to Naples. It's a terrific city and the food is wondrous.
It's absolutely astonishing. And anything that has anything to do with that deserves UNESCO heritage and more.
I am looking at the UNESCO Intangible Heritage List. I have to say I am both... Well, I'm frankly outraged and insulted at the lack of Australian contributions this. In fact, there doesn't seem to be anything.
Can you throw a few potential options in there, Andrew, for us?
I scarcely know where to... Where did we invent dwarf hurling?
One of my favourites comes from actually Uzbekistan, and this is from the list from 2014. It's called Askia, the Art of Wit. So witty conversations in Uzbekistan
are on the intangible. Protect that.
I'm just hearing from the United Nations that we are not eligible for that in the studio, unfortunately.
I don't know. I've never been to Uzbekistan. Are they an unusually funny people? Do we know that for a...
I would surely want to find out.
Very practiced in the art of
wit. I'm just basically scrolling through here, Carlotta, looking for Portugal in search of something to make fun
of. That's a handout, though, isn't it? That's like giving Hull European City of Culture.
Yeah, well, the trouble is that the Portuguese entries are all really cool, because, of course, you have the fado and you have polyphonic singing from
Alentejo. But you also have the making, and that's probably... You can make fun of that, Portuguese cowbells. That's on the list.
Are these bells that you hang on cows or bells shaped like cows?
Bells that you hang on cows, but now are used as a musical instrument.
Are the bells that you hang on cows also shaped like cows?
No, that would be too much.
Could I throw in a nomination for Britain?
Please.
To pick up on a note that Carlotta struck earlier about perceptions of the country. So we supposedly pride ourselves on our drinking prowess.
A pint.
But maybe we're not quite as good enough. However, Britain is one of a few countries, I think, around the world where people drink on their way to go drinking. So I'd put that in there.
The pre-lash.
Is that?
Would you like to see the pre-lash?
Putting on a handsome...
Codified the coat as of a protected
primer,
item.
The coat of primer I nominate for UNESCO protection. Hear
I
me
second
now.
That. I second
you,
that.
You are nominating for intangible cultural heritage recognition the practice of drinking on the train.
Pre-drinking on the train, Andrew.
Pre-drinking. And pre-lash. Do you want to throw anything in there, Henry? You've got about 5 seconds.
When I tried to think of something that was both a cultural product of Swansea and that was intangible...
I said five seconds, not 5 hours.
I had to rack my brains. Back in my day, there was a martial arts manoeuvre, shall we call it, called the Swansea Shank, which involved punching someone while holding your key between your knuckles so it made a miniature stabbing knife. That is intangible. I'm not sure if it would be eligible for protection.
I'd say it
fulfills the criteria.
I'd say it was pretty tangible if you were on the receiving end of it. That does bring us to the end of today's show. Carlotta Rebello, Henry Rees-Sheridan and Tom Edwards, thank you for joining us at Midori House. House. The show was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Alessio Dallana. Our studio manager was Christy Evans. More music next, 1900, Marcus Hippie with The Menu. The Daily has more on the day's big stories at 2200. Midori House returns on Monday at 1800 London. I'm Andrew Muller. Have a great weekend. Thank you for listening.